I'm Edna Branch Jackson, and I was born here in Savannah, Chatham County, on September 18th, 1944, so you can see I'm quite old. I was born on what they call the west side of town, in what is known as a section called Currytown. Currytown was one of the poor areas here in Savannah. My household, the first household that we lived in, had no running water on the inside and the outdoor toilets and what have you. I was reared by my grandmother and an aunt and uncle, because my mother moved to Florida when I was quite young, and my sister and I remained here with my grandmother. And my mother, in order for my mother to get a job and take care of us and send the funds back. So we stayed here, and as a result of that, we're products of the public schools here in Savannah. Wow. Okay, in the neighborhood that we grew up in, it was a neighborhood. You know, you knew everybody, everyone knew you, and everyone helped to raise the other person's child. So you had to answer to everyone if you did something wrong. For instance, let me give you a for instance. In my neighborhood, when you walked down the street, you had to say everybody's name. How are you doing, Miss Lula Allen? How are you doing, Miss Georgia Reed? And if you didn't, they would come and tell my grandmother, Sadie Branch, well, that child didn't speak to me today. You know, it was kind of, that was part of your home training. Mm-hmm. Not only that, even though my grandmother only had a third grade education, the neighborhood people taught each other, but they saw the importance of getting an education, so they stayed on you. I can remember that my grandmother always made sure that there were books and newspapers in the house for us to read, and one of the things that she wanted us to do most was to study. So we were kind of spoiled as far as housework is concerned, because that's what she wanted us to do, and it paid off. I am a product, as I said, of the public school system. I attended the Florence Street Elementary School in Savannah. It is still operating now as a school. And of course, all of these schools back then were segregated. Mm. I went on from Florence Street Elementary School from first through seventh grade, and then I entered the Kyla Junior High School. And of course, you know, when you go to junior high school, you think you have arrived and you're half grown by then. Mm-hmm. I attended Kyler 8th and 9th, and schools then, of course, still were segregated. And I went from there to the Alfred Ely Beach Senior High School from 10th through 12th grade. During this time, the teachers that were a part of the school were very interested in you learning. In other words, if you act like you didn't want to learn, they made you learn. One of the things that I was always good at reciting, you know, and doing long poems and stuff like that. So I was always used and encouraged by my teachers to do those kinds of things. Not only that, in the public school system, the teachers made you aware of the government, of your rights, but they couldn't openly, in some instances, tell you you need to protest against this, that, or the other because of fear of their jobs. Back in those days, it was against the law for teachers to be a part of the NAACP. And during that time, you know, if they took out a membership, it had to be done sort of undercover. And I always remember one lady that was not afraid to do this, and that's Mrs. Addie Bird Byers. And, you know, she was just very open and very persistent about what she did. I think people like her and some other instructors, teachers that I had served as a guiding force in my life. But the one person that was my mentor and still is my mentor even today is W.W. Law. And I say that because he really made me aware of my history, the history of black people. Mr. Law used to come to I was in the youth council at the age of 9, the NAACP Youth Council. And a part of talking with us about our rights, he would come in and do history sessions with us to make us aware of the tremendous history that we have. And he introduced us to books by E. Franklin Frazier, W.B. Du Bois, you know, John Hope Franklin, and And it made you aware of from whence you've come. And as a result of that, I got involved in the civil rights movement here in Savannah. And he made us aware that, you know, none of us were free unless all of us were free, and the injustices. Let me tell you a little bit about Savannah back in the 50s, too. Back then, down in the downtown area, if there was a lunch counter for blacks, it may have been in the lower unit of Crest, okay? Couldn't eat upstairs. You will experience water fountains that said white and colored. You didn't say black then, it was colored. Or you may have restrooms for white males, white females, and colored. One. Okay, so those are the kinds of inequities that we went through back in the 60s. I mean, in the 50s, when I was coming along. Not only that, even, and I'm rambling some, you know, okay, even with the public school system back then, we were, even though I took the more advanced level classes, our teachers had to be, ingeniuses in some instances, because we didn't have the textbooks, new textbooks and what have you. We had the used textbooks that were handed down from the white schools. Not only that, in my chemistry class, we may have 5 Bunsen burners in the whole class of 30 people. Or in biology, you know, you may have to dissect the frog. You may have 2. So, but they used different methods to teach us, to get it over to us, and we were able to learn. And I wouldn't take that away from, I think now maybe the, you know, teachers aren't ingenious about bringing up some of the things. It's a little too easy for them. The teachers in the school system back there encouraged you to move forward, as I said earlier. If you did something wrong, then they had a right to chastise you or to tell your parents. Now, I was, as I said earlier, I was reared by my grandmother with a third grade education, but she was very much interested in our education. She was very much a part of the Parent Teachers Association. So if Edna did anything in class, she knew about it, and not only was I punished at school, but I received the whipping when I got home. Yes, I did. You know, we didn't spare the rod, and I think they're sparing the rod too much now. In front of our house, we had an old chinaberry tree. I don't know, it's a little berry. You're familiar with chinaberry tree. Okay. And my grandmother would send me out to get a switch off the chinaberry tree, and you strip it, take all the leaves out, and that's what she would, you know, whip me with.
And you'd have to get it yourself.
I would have to go and get it, and I didn't have to, and if I brought a short one, she would go get a long one.
Do you think that was typical of many families?
Yes. The discipline in the black household was there.
Right.
I think it was very much so, more so back then than it is now.
And in what way did you first feel that something was wrong, that there was a stigma?
The awareness came when you go downtown or riding a bus and you had to go to the back of the bus and the front part of the bus was empty. Those kinds of things, or you see the water fountains, or you go and you were told that you could not go to the theaters in the downtown area. You had to go to the theaters only in the black community.
And what sort of feelings did that arouse in you?
It made you feel that that you were not as good as others, as whites were.
And it made you almost believe that, did it?
Yeah, well, it made me think about it, but then on the other hand, as I said, the school teachers were there to reinforce that you were just as good as anybody on this earth, and you had to be better in order to move on. Well, you know, the professions for blacks back then were teachers, preachers, you know, you had very few doctors and lawyers and stuff like that. So my teachers were very important in my life, and they made me aware of the fact that, you know, I can do whatever I wanted to do. And of course, like I said, Mr. Law, and talking to us and talking about equal rights and what we needed to fight for in this community. NAACP really made me aware of all of the inequities.
Were many children as aware and interested as you in the NAACP and in learning about your history and protesting for?
Well, I wouldn't say a lot. I remember the time when we had a youth council of over 1,000 students, yes. We had the largest youth council in the southeastern region of NAACP. And this was at the beginning of the 60s. The first national convention I attended was in 1960 in Atlanta, Georgia. And it really made me aware of some things then, too, because we couldn't live in the hotels there. We had to live on college campuses.
Right. So how did the NAACP practically organize itself amongst the young people in the 50s?
Well, it was already organized.
Right.
See, the NAACP was very thriving
during
that time. Mr. Law was a very young man back in the 50s. But you have to realize that he was a part of the youth group long before I became a part of the youth group.
Right.
So he just took what he got as a young person and carried it on and involved all of us, along with people like Mrs. Stell. She's dead, she's deceased now, but she who was also one of the advisors back in that time, during that time.
And what would be your typical program for a week? In the 50s, in the NAACP youth?
Well, we met once a week, and we talked about the organization, the organizational structure. They also talked to us about things like parliamentary procedure,
right.
Survival, you know, being involved, your civic commitment, voter registration, and what we could do to help. But the foremost thing, I think, would be the history.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it prepared the way for the 60s in
that
way.
Definitely it prepared the way, and NAACP prepared the way. If you know the history of NAACP from its inception, you will know that it had always been in the fight for equal rights. And we just picked up as young people and carried it on. You know, when the demonstration started in North Carolina, we wanted to do the same kinds of things. So we decided that we were going to go down and sit in and ask for our equal rights also.
So why do you think that, given your awareness and your enthusiasm earlier, why do you think it wasn't until March 1960 that the first boycotts and sit-ins happened? Why the point
in
the 50s?
Some minor things were being done,
right.
You know, for equal rights.
What sort of things?
The right to vote.
Right.
To get them to do away with the literacy test. Those are some of the things that were being carried on. But remember now, we were young and we took our guidance from our adults.
Right.
But then once the students started demonstrating, we decided that we wanted to get out there in the 62. Remember, we were only 14 or 15
yes,
years
right.
old
right.
when we decided that we wanted to go down and demonstrate also.
So you, almost the trigger was because of the student activities going on elsewhere in the country.
All over the country. When North Carolina, in Greensboro, North Carolina
right.
started, it kind of triggered and we decided that we wanted to do the same thing. I think North Carolina started a couple of months earlier than
That's
we
right.
did. And we immediately decided that since we had an active youth council, and there was a young man that is deceased now, Benjamin Clark, really wanted to do this, and he was a very pro-activist. And Mr. Law encouraged it. And, you know, the thing was, we knew that we were probably going to go to jail, and
right.
we had to put a program together. You know, during those days, we went through training sessions, too.
Right. What sort of training? What did it involve?
Okay, the nonviolent movement.
And how would you be trained in nonviolent movement?
To see if you could take the pressures of someone hitting you and you're not hitting back, to do the nonviolent kind of thing. We were really, in some ways, I think we were indoctrinated that what we were doing, it was right, and we knew it was right. But in order to be successful in it, that we could not fight back. Mm. Now, that was a problem with me. Because I'd always had a very bad temper.
Right.
And I always felt that if somebody hit me, I knew if somebody hit me, I was going to hit back. But then we were told if one person hit back, then we would destroy everything that we were trying to do. And it worked. Nobody did. Nobody hit back.
Why do you think people followed nonviolence? Was it because you thought it was going to work, or because you agreed that it was the right method of approach?
Well, I think we were convinced that it was going to work. You know,
right.
you look at the activities of Mahatma Gandhi,
right.
all of this became a part of everything that we was doing. He was successful, so I think that with his movement, it let us know that, you know, history can repeat itself in a sense
yes.
in another area.
And Mr. Law had taught you about Mahatma Gandhi.
Oh, yes, definitely so. That's right. He is a walking history book.
So Why did you... Your first activities in the 60s were the sit-ins.
The sit-ins, yeah.
Why did you target that as the first...
That, it was targeted all over the country.
Right.
Yeah. And that was something that the students could do.
Right.
You know, we as young people could go out and... But we had to do it with the support of the adults.
Right. So who would organize your program? Would you organize it and go to the adults and say, we want to sit in here? Is that all right? Or would they suggest it to you?
No. We did it together.
Right.
The advisors, the leaders, people like Gene Gadsden, we came up with a plan.
Right.
Because we knew that once we were arrested, somebody had to get us out of jail.
Right.
So, and during that time, once we formulated the plan, once we went through the training, and the training involved not only the nonviolent movement, but how we dressed.
Mm.
You know, we didn't go down in jeans and shorts. We went down in dresses. The men went in shirt and ties, or their sweaters, or what have you. That was very much a part of the demonstration, because we didn't want them to say that a bunch of thugs.
Right.
Were out there trying to be served or raising hell or what have you. So that was a part of it. Not only that, when you talk about the nonviolent movement, you also think about something that they could say could be used as a weapon.
Mm.
So we also could not carry pens, pencils, fingernail files, anything that could be used as a weapon. So we were really helpless if somebody did attack us. And then we would, you know, but we were trained that way, and it worked.
Now, you had support from the NAACP.
Right.
What about the black community as a whole?
Total support from the black community. We were able to get the professional people and homeowners in the community to put up their property for bond for us in order to get us out of jail. You know, because they wanted property bond or cash. And that was the only way that it could be handled.
So... you drew support from the activities of students elsewhere in the country.
Well, now the Savannah movement.
Right.
Now the Savannah movement only involved the Savannah students.
Right.
Okay.
So you didn't have visiting students from Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee?
No. Savannah was an NAACP town.
Right.
Okay.
Totally.
And we did all of the demonstrating here.
Right.
In the city. No, CORE never did come into Savannah. They may have come in to speak or something like that. But we were totally under the control of NAACP.
Right. So if they came, they would come to an NAACP meeting?
That's right.
And that there was no rivalry between the different groups here?
No. Because there was no organization of CORE in Savannah.
Right.
NAACP was it.
That's great.
And, you know, when we were demonstrating, we used to have every Sunday a mass meeting, Sunday afternoon mass meeting. And that's when we talked about it. It was a motivation kind of meeting, and people would get up and talk and, you know, say why we were doing this, and all the young people would come in. But one of the things that we did first, we put God first.
Right.
Because it was very important. Before we went out to demonstrate, we prayed.
Right.
And the last thing we did when we got out of jail at night was to go back to the church and pray. First African Baptist Church was used mainly as our headquarters for waiting for people to get out of jails and to get started.
So it was almost your prayer headquarters, in other
words.
Right.
That's right.
So would you say that your Christian beliefs as a whole were absolutely crucial in the movement?
Oh, definitely so. Definitely so. You know, and as I think about it, as I told you, I had had a very bad temper back then. I could think of many times, not only here in Savannah when I worked in other areas of people coming up and just pouring something on you like coffee or something like that, and you can't fight back. If you know you have a bad temper, you want to strike back. But one of the songs during the Civil Rights Movement has always remained with me, and that's We Shall Overcome.
Right.
You know, and I could sit there and just hum or think of the words of We Shall Overcome, and it brought back the belief in the nonviolent movement.
So how would the chorus, the refrain to that go, you can just say that.
Oh, we shall overcome, we shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome. That's just one part of it goes on, you know, black and white together, and, you know, I can, you know, there are so many verses of it. And when you have a bunch of people singing, the harmony is just so beautiful.
So, Why don't you explain perhaps what happened at your first sit-in, if you can remember?
Okay. Well, yes. I was one of the ones that went down to CREF.
And this was the first one in Savannah?
This was the very first one, but the first arrest was down at the Levy's department store.
Right.
In the Azalea room. That's where my girlfriend was arrested. The first three people were arrested there. But we were in CREF, and once some were arrested, we were pulled out and sent back to the church. But they continued and continued and continued.
And so what response did you get when you went to CREF?
Very negative.
Right.
Very negative. They didn't want to serve you there. They were told not to serve you. And there were the little remarks that were made, like calling you a nigger, why are you doing, what are you doing here, you know, and you have no right to be here, what have you.
Right. Was there any support at all you could see amongst the whites there?
You know, that's so long ago,
it's
very hard to recall. Now, there were some whites that were very active in the community, and I can't recall their names right now,
right,
that were instrumental in the civil rights movement. It was not just a total black demonstration. Even though when we first started, there were no whites demonstrating with us.
Right. And your general philosophy, you'll know that later the Black Power movement came, quite assertive and aggressive. Were you much more just pushing for integration and...
Yeah, we were pushing for integration, for jobs.
Right.
You know,
And did you think was there any sort of racism reciprocated back towards the white community?
Well, you know, what happened here, the Black Power movement, they're not really coming to Savannah
right
that much. Well, you know, you had people talking Black Power, and that was fine in a sense if you're talking about Black Power as far as being positive,
right,
and making people aware of themselves. That was fine, but the fighting back, no, we weren't
right
doing anything.
So how long would you have to sit in for on a typical...
You could sit in for an hour, you know, and leave, and, you know, and go back to the church.
And
but it was making a statement.
Right. And were you ever yourself tempted to relinquish your nonviolence? Or...
Not in Savannah, but in Florida, when I was demonstrating in Florida.
Ah, so you went to Florida, St. Augustine, was it?
No, I was in a little town called Live Oak, Florida. I was assigned to Tampa, under the field director in Tampa, but then I was sent from there to Live Oak, Florida, between Jacksonville and Tallahassee,
mm-hmm,
very small community. And my responsibility was to train people, as I was trained, to go and demonstrate.
When was this, roughly?
This was in 1960, I left here in 1963.
Right.
1963. And it was very rough because you had a lot of what we call rednecks. And here I am telling the young people now, if they do anything to you, you can't fight back. But there were times when there was one fella, I'll never forget, he was about, I would say, to me now, I would picture him as being about 6'7" or maybe 5". Very big guy, you know, and he would always, he and his little group would always harass us as we were going down to demonstrate to sit in. And I had this guy from Jacksonville, Florida, working with me, who was just as big and very dark, very dark. And they would always go after him, but we would always hold back. Well, one day, we ran into this fellow by himself, and we were not demonstrating. And we told him now that we were not nonviolent when we were out here. We were nonviolent as long as we were demonstrating, but away from the demonstration, we were going to protect ourselves. And as a result of having a confrontation with him one-on-one, he kind of ceased his activities, and we didn't have to go through with that anymore. Also, in that area, when I was there doing NAACP work, CORE was there doing voter registration. And all of us were living in this minister's home, a black minister's home. CORE had whites on their staff and it was very helpful. And of course, in a small Florida community, when you have white and black people going together to various places and stuff like that, the white community was very resentful of that.
Mm. So there was more white involvement there than there was in Savannah.
Well, you mean, they didn't sit in with us.
Right.
They were only doing the voter registration.
Right.
Yeah. But now, I'll tell you where we did have some whites involved, and that was in Tampa, Florida. Mm-hmm. I worked in Tampa, Florida. I did all of the demonstrations there just before the Civil Rights Bill was passed. And we did have an integrated group in Tampa that was doing demonstrations under the leadership of a Reverend Laurie. I think he's on the school board now. We trained them. You know, I trained them, and they went to jail. And and as a result of that, when the Civil Rights Movement, Civil Rights Bill was passed, the places like Morrison's Cafeteria and everything opened up,
right.
The theaters. And of course, we led those demonstrations in Florida. And remember now, I was real young then, quite young, and I was responsible for carrying the group to the March on Washington.
Really?
That's right. The black community rented 3 station wagons. Or let us borrow 3 station wagons. And we drove in an integrated group from Tampa, Florida to Washington, D.C. It was fascinating.
And it was a good experience.
That's right. Yeah. Very good.
So it seems that while very few outsiders came into Savannah, that Savannah sent people away.
Yes.
Were you an exception, or were there others like
that? No. There were other members of other youth councils that went to other areas out of South Carolina and other parts of Georgia. NAACP had a way of taking people that they saw as potential leaders and moving them on through the organization. And of course, we were assigned to the regional directors to work. Not regional, right, state directors to work.
How did you compare the movement in Savannah to the other areas you went to?
Savannah was just exciting, but at least here, we had, I think, the leadership here, like Mr. Law and Jean Gaston and Mercedes Wright and others, was very forceful. Mm-hmm. I mean, you felt good about it. When we went to Florida, we became the leader. When I went to Florida, I became the leader. You know, I was taking the role that they were taking. And I don't know, I think Savannah really made its mark on me.
Right. Uh-huh. And when you protested, who were you doing it for? Were you doing it for yourself, your family, for God, for your race? What motivated you?
I was doing it, all of the above.
Everything.
Yeah, because I wasn't doing it just for me.
Right.
You know, I had to look at what's to come in the future. You know, we were being discriminated against, and as I said earlier, if one person did not have their freedom, no one had their freedom. You know, you can give me something, and I may benefit from it, but the total black community can't benefit from it, then it's not good enough for me.
Right. And maybe a difficult question to answer, but amongst the young people in Savannah, who would they draw their inspiration from? Would it be local leaders like Mr. Law, Jean Gaston, Mercedes Wright, or would it be the national figures?
In Savannah, it was more of the local figures.
Right.
Definitely so. Yeah, and when I, you know, people like Jean and Wesley and Merce were very forceful, very outspoken. I can remember the day. We'll be here forever.
That's okay.
I can remember when we used to go around, and this, well, we're going to get to voter registration, but we used to go around in small communities in Georgia, organizing voter registration and get out the vote kind of campaigns. And I'll never forget, Jean Gaston, Mercedes, and I went to, and Curtis Cooper, and I went to a small town. We were going to a small town. Well, we had to use the restroom. So we stopped for gas, and of course, when we asked for the key to the restroom, the man said, "It's around the back." Well, that was the colored restroom. We wanted to go to the restroom. And I'll never forget, they were putting the gas in the car, and Mercedes said, "Take the gas out of the car. We are not buying gas here. We cannot use the restrooms that we want to use." And that was the kind of forcefulness as far as the leadership we had. You know, they were very forceful. They didn't take a backseat to anybody.
And that's in every aspect of their life.
In every aspect of their life. And they instilled it in us.
So while it was exciting and I'm sure very fulfilling, were there some real negative drawbacks? What sort of sacrifices did you have to make, do you feel?
Well, the sacrifices, I think, was that even though you were totally committed to the Civil Rights Movement, it took all of your time.
Mm.
So I didn't do some of the things that a lot of the young people in the community were doing. Mm. You know, to me, my priority was civil rights, and it was not the parties or the theater, because I was demonstrating, trying to get in the ones that So you kind of put your life on hold.
You say that a lot of the other students weren't as involved as you. Mm-hmm. What would they think about what you were doing, though? Would they be fully in support?
Well, some of them, yes. And some of them, you have to realize that some of the parents would not allow their students
right.
to demonstrate.
Right.
And so they had to sort of just look and see what you were doing, you know, because they didn't want them to get hurt. But then, you know...
Was there apathy at all amongst others?
In some areas, but not that... I wouldn't say there was totally. I think we had more people supporting us than there was apathy.
Right.
Because remember now, if we were free, they were free.
Exactly.
You know, when the restaurants opened up, and it was a different thing. You know, here I was coming from a very poor community. Yeah, we had the money in our pocket in case they wanted to serve us. But then once they opened up, I may not have had that money to go down there and eat, coming from a very poor area.
Right.
That's right.
So how long did it take for the lunch counters to open up?
When the Civil Rights Bill was passed.
not until 64?
Not until then.
Right.
That's right. We did an economic boycott of the downtown area.
Right. Just before we get to that, did you carry on sitting in sporadically right until 64?
Well, it wasn't just sitting in. Mm. You know, yes, we did. We just didn't sit in. We
right.
carried on other activities as
so
well. To keep the momentum going, you
right.
know, we had to move to other areas.
Right. So the economic boycott, how did that work?
Beautifully.
And in practice, how did you achieve that?
What we did, we went around and we told people that we did not want them to shop on Broughton Street.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the majority of the people did not shop on Broughton Street. But some of your nicer stores, like the Levy's department stores and Fine's very exclusive women's clothing store, and you had the Belks and the Hogan's and stuff, what they would do for their customers, they would have their salespeople to call them, and they would send the merchandise out to the house.
Right.
Because, see, we had picket lines going up. And if you crossed the picket line, we knew it.
Yeah.
And then we were in our regular Sunday afternoon mass meetings. We called the list. We would say, Mrs. So-and-so-and-so was seen going in Hogan's. Or Mrs. So-and-so-and-so.
Well, you couldn't hold your face up in the community.
Oh, no, not if you crossed the picket line, okay? Then, so what would happen, if the truck went to somebody's house, they would call into the office or call one of the leaders and say, I want you to know that the Levy's department store truck was at Mr. So-and-so's house. Then that person's name became a part of the list. And during that time, you know, we buy clothes, okay?
Right.
Easter. Now, we are going to buy Christmas and Easter for our children. Back then, the only place you could buy it for Easter was on West Broad Street, which is now Martin Luther King Boulevard. Well, there were a number of small stores along there, but they always had black sales help. So that's where we shopped. It may not have been the best of goods, but we shopped there. It was, you know, a lot of my stuff came from the West Broad Street stores anyway, okay? Because that's what my parents could afford, right? But we could do that, or we didn't buy it all. I mean, you were last year's Easter, and we were proud of that. Because Broughton Street was going broke
and were
because of the economic boycott. Pardon?
And in what ways could you see that?
Well, because, you know, all you had to do was read the paper to see that, you know, people were not making any money.
Right.
You know, and then not only was it Broughton Street, but we were demonstrating at the supermarkets, too, for cashiers. I would never get Bargain Corner that used to be on Bay Street, where the Days Inn is located now.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be one of the largest grocery stores in Savannah that had one of the largest black clientele. And Shores Market was another one that was right in the intercity. We refused to hire blacks on the register. They went out of business. They went out of business. But if that was their preference, that happened. But that's why I say we were demonstrating downtown. We were boycotting the places that would not hire black in sales or what have you, or as cashiers. Then we were doing voter registration,
right.
increasing the numbers. That was when we became a better political here. We had to increase the numbers of, because without the right to vote or the number of votes, I think we went from 2,000 black voters, and I stand corrected if someone else tell you different, to now there are 24,000, better than 24,000 blacks on the roll, voter registration roll. There are like 26,000 whites on the registration roll. So you can see it's almost a balance there. But we were going and taking people to vote, I mean to register, and of course then to vote. We had to turn out to vote.
Now you had things like literacy tests and what have you.
That was before the 60s. They threw out the literacy test, so we didn't have to deal with that in the 60s. It was merely just taking them down to register.
Right. Why did they throw it out in the 50s? Was it
the government.
The whole of the country.
Yes. All over, yeah.
Right.
Well, Mississippi didn't throw it out, you know.
Right,
but,
yes.
Yeah. Then we became politically involved. You're going to run out of tape.
No, I'm sure. I've got 20 hours.
Okay. We became politically involved. We began to work with city government, and the power of black people was in the black vote. And we had, as an offspring of the NAACP, we had the Political Advisory Council, the NAACP Political Advisory Council. See, NAACP could not endorse candidates, right? That's still the policy of the organization. But the Political Advisory Council could endorse candidates. Well, the makeup of the organization was the same makeup of the NAACP, okay? So what we would do, we would go in, we would research the people that were running to see if they would see if they had done anything for the black community. Then we would make a judgment and vote on who we would endorse.
Right.
And back then, we block voted.
And how would you spread the message? Through the mass meetings or?
Well, somewhat, but then back in the 60s, if you let your votes, let people know too early who you were endorsing, they would turn it against you, and whites would come out in droves and vote.
For the other person.
Just for the other person. So what we would do back then, we would not put our flyer out until television sound. When we first started, they used to take our sample ballot and put it on television. Mm. Okay? So everyone knew who we were going to support. So the whites came out for the opposite candidate. So we got smart. Television used to go off at 11 o'clock back then. We would start hitting the streets at 11 o'clock at night, and we would work until 7 o'clock that morning, covering the total black community, asking people to go to the polls and vote. And we block voted completely, and we were able to get some people that were responsive. They were whites, responsive to the needs of the black community.
And can you remember any of the people who you got in?
One was Malcolm McLean.
Right.
Oh, God.
Was he much more helpful than the previous man?
Oh, yes, very much so. Very much so. I can't recall. Gene Gadsden.
He was the one I was
thinking. Yes.
So what was the Chatham Crusade for Voters?
That was an offspring. That was a group that broke off from the Political Advisory Council.
Were they still
under
part
Jose
of the
Williams.
NAACP for a time, or?
No, they came under, after a while, Martin Luther King came into Savannah, and a group broke off and became part of SCLC.
Why do you think they did that?
Well, you know, you start getting a power struggle,
right.
And you have some people that want to be leaders, and they don't want to work under the leadership of someone else.
Right.
So they became their own leaders in their own rights. And there was nothing wrong with that. And they demonstrated some here, you know, with the street marches and what have you also.
And you think that was a good thing?
Well, it didn't hurt.
Right.
It did not hurt.
It didn't hurt the
no.
community that there were independent groups?
No.
Right.
To me, it did not hurt.
Right.
I would have preferred it being totally one group. Mm. But no, it didn't hurt. But you have people that want to do their own thing, their own way. And Jose Williams was one of that. And of course, as a result of him getting involved with SCLC, he went on to be one of the national leaders with
right.
SCLC.
And who went with him?
Ben Clark. There were a couple of people, Ben Clark very vividly. That was during the same time that we went to Florida with NAACP. Ben Clark chose to go with SCLC, and he worked as the same as we did. But the only difference in that was that, you know, we were so indoctrinated into what we were doing, or so we believed in what we were doing. There were times when they said to us, NAACP said to us, you need to take a break. And I think with SCLC they continued with the young people. They didn't take breaks. I appreciated what happened to me because, I say, I dropped out of college to do civil rights work because I felt like I didn't need no education if I didn't have civil rights.
Yeah.
It was more important. But then NAACP said to me, you need to go back to college. You know, you need to get your degree.
When was this?
I returned to college in 65.
Right,
after Civil Rights passed, March in Washington. I was in college during the March from Selma to Montgomery, but I was allowed to participate in it. You know, my professors at the college understood what it meant to me, and NAACP, they flew me in to Alabama in order for me to participate. You know, but that's why, you know, NAACP was good to me. And not only that, you know, being a young person, NAACP sent me back to college. And I'm talking about paying for it.
They paid for you.
The national paid. We had a national youth director at that time, a guy by the name LaPlante Ashford.
Right.
And then we also had, his successor was Mark Roseman. Mark was Jewish, was brought up in upstate New York, and not had the black experience. I tease them about that all the time. And they made it, you know, perfectly clear, you know, that you are going back to college, and I did it. You know,
that's great.
He sent me.
So, just back to the economic boycott.
Okay.
Some firms went under. Some firms made very little money because of the boycott.
That's right.
Did any of them actually change their policy and
stuff? Oh yes, yes. Those departments, those grocery, most of the department stores began hiring black cashiers.
And this is before the Civil Rights Act?
No. Let me see. Oh, God. Let me get. See, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, I was in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Don't let me say they did. Yeah, they started the bargaining prior to the Civil Rights Act.
Right.
And, of course, the hiring practices began. Talking a long time, 30 years.
And the kneelings. Why the kneelings?
Well,
the
most segregated hour in this country is the 11 o'clock hour on Sunday morning. And we feel whites had always had the privilege of worshiping with us. And that was one barrier that we felt like there is one God. All of us should be allowed to work, to worship together.
Mm.
And of course, we were not allowed to do that, to the point of officials and ministers coming out of the church and telling you that you just could not come in. But we had to make a statement.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the kneeling would be attempting to...
to worship at white churches.
Uh-huh. And, well, obviously this was extremely nonviolent, but how would they not allow you to enter? Because
we
couldn't use the strong arm tactics.
No, we weren't going to force our way either.
Right.
But we just went to the doors to see if we could go in.
Right.
And of course, they blocked the doors.
Right.
But your deacons or your church officials just would block the doors. And you couldn't get in.
Did you try kneeling in at any other...
So we would kneel. And the thing too, we would kneel in front of the church.
Right.
Okay.
And the wading as well.
Wade and Tybee.
Yeah.
And there was a song to the... with that one, let me tell you.
Yes, do.
Wade and Tybee. Brown skins, Wade and Tybee.
Right.
Now that was an experience. I'll never forget. I had come back from doing some civil rights work in another area. They would, like I said, NAACP would even make us come back, or they would give us a retreat to get us away from everything. Well, I came in one weekend and they were doing the wait-ins. I was not a part of the original group that went to Tybee. And I told my grandmother that I was going to the beach. Well, but I didn't tell her what beach. So. And we went to Savannah Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And before we could get down to the beach area, they were waiting on us. And they arrested us.
Before you even got there?
Before we got to the sandy part of the beach. We were on the island. But they stopped us and they arrested us for disrobing in public.
And had you disrobed by this time?
We didn't. We had on swimsuits and beach coats. But that was a charge. we were disrobing. Oh, yeah, if you take your beach coat off, I mean, is that disrobing in public? You know, some people, when they first started, used to go down in their clothes. Well, they paid no attention to it at first because, you know, blacks worked on Ellen. You know, they were the housekeepers or what have you. But then they got us for disrobing in public, and they put us in jail down at Tybee. And a typical meal. Well, let me tell you this. We went to jail, and one of the people that, Donald Cook was one of the people that went to jail with us during that time. When they put us in, we just knew we were going to just go in and get out. Well, we had to stay overnight. They didn't get us out. So, of course, Gene Gaston was our lawyer at that time, so I told him to please call my grandmother to let them know where I was. And, of course, we were. They did get the bond and everything, and we were out the next day. But our breakfast that morning was fried bologna, fried bologna. And you know, grits. Have you had grits since you've been here?
I imagine them.
Okay, grits is like a cereal. Some people eat it with cream and butter, but we eat it with just butter.
Right.
Okay, grainy grits, of hominy grits, okay. Well, they gave you, the grits had sat for so long until they got hard and lumpy. And they must have put some water in them to stir them up again to make them soft, but the lumps were still there. But we had that and cornbread. I think it was cornbread that day.
not the best breakfast.
Not the best breakfast. Well, in the jail down here, in the Savannah jail, they would give you fried fatback and beans or whatever.
So you feel you're quite an expert on food in jails.
Oh, yes. I tell my son about it. I said, now, jail is a place that you would not want to go. And even though we were doing it for a cause, it's still a place you wouldn't want to go.
Especially not for a meal.
Not for a meal. But now they say they're better. Back then they weren't.
you haven't been recently?
No.
So, again, when did the Wadens achieve success, do you think?
Well, when they opened up all public facilities.
Right.
They had to open up the beaches also. And the reception down there was not that great as with the restaurants and everything. The reception was not that great, but they couldn't turn us away.
Right. Yeah. And again, this was done maybe before the Civil Rights Act, was it?
No, this was after the Civil Rights Act was passed.
So, little was achieved in sort of concrete terms until after the Civil Rights Act.
The majority of the achievements were made after the Civil Rights Act was passed.
Was that discouraging at all over the 3 years?
No, not necessarily, because you were continuously working. You knew you would eventually reach your goal.
Right.
So it was not discouraging. It made you fight harder.
Right.
You know, and I think I know it made me fight harder.
Savannah has had far less violence than any